Thank you. Tess Dunham, Somax, Simmons & Dunn, and I'm going to continue with our presentation. And at the February workshop, I believe that we talked about, you know, the fact that we had the new September 2011 order. Much of what we had submitted previously was based on previous orders, and there seemed to be an interest, you know, in looking at what changes the staff had made. What changes did we still feel absolutely necessary? So we've gone back. We've reevaluated the September 2011 order as well as what we have proposed, and we have tried to really prioritize and select in the, you know, auspice of negotiation, as discussed earlier, what we think would be the necessary appropriate changes. And while it'll look like there's a lot of slides when you think conceptually of everything that's within this order, we've really tried to limit it to a few number of significant changes for us. So with that... Okay, and I have put them in order of the draft order in paragraph, identify the paragraph and the page number, and this is off of the September 2011. So hopefully we can follow. The first is, you know, we originally had our ag proposal discussed within what we called the attachment B. And in reevaluating everything, it seemed that it might be more appropriate if the ag alternative, as we had proposed, was included as a specific provision or a part within the order. And so we are proposing that today in showing it how that would fit within the order itself, within the specific language. This is your paragraph 10, where the staff is starting to refer to a cooperative program. And we have modified this slightly to reflect that what we call Part E, and which we'll get to, but I have a new Part E here that we'll go through to explain what the ag proposal would be within this context, which is not much different from what we put before.
Ms. Dunham?
Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but just for clarification, Mr. Chairman and Francis, is this new information? Do we need a ruling or to discuss whether it's new information? How do we handle this?
No, it's okay if she presents this information and then...
I can't hear you.
It is okay if she presents this information, and the board will have to take it under consideration whether they can want to consider any of these.
It's okay to present new information?
There is no new information.
What is Part E?
Part E is our former attachment B. It's essentially the same thing reformatted. There is no new information being presented.
Okay. Thank you.
Am I on?
I don't know.
I just want to be sure I understood that. You have a section of your proposed order that was called something else prior and now is being referred to as Part E?
That's correct.
And what was it formally called?
Attachment B in the ag proposal.
Attachment B. Okay, very good.
So this is a modification to the current September 11th draft order for paragraph 10 to recognize the Part E. This would be a new paragraph that just provides further clarification as to which general conditions apply to the various tiers. One of the, and some of the things we're proposing here is to address concerns as expressed by staff. Staff had expressed concerns that it wasn't clear what provisions applied to which tiers within the ag proposal, so this new paragraph would clarify that the provisions in parts B, C, D, and H would apply to everybody. Those include the notice of intent, the farm plans, all of the management, the general conditions for management practices, et cetera, would all apply, and which provisions would not due to selecting the option of Part E. And also, as we get later on, I think it doesn't, but we've also have included some time schedule provisions that we'll talk about. Next is, again, to recognize if the board were to choose to adopt the ag alternative, there would need to be a change that in paragraph 18, where if the executive officer elevated someone from a current tier 1 or tier 2 to a higher tier, and someone had not chosen the ag alternative, should the board include it, they should have the opportunity at that point in time. So it's to recognize a potential change in tiers based upon the EO's discretion. The next portions are more about, Ms. Fisher discussed the immediate compliance with water quality standards and the current language in paragraph 21, which we have expressed considerable concern with over time, and the fact that staff has indicated that they would use their discretion with respect to enforcement, that is fine, but it doesn't provide me or my clients with much comfort considering the fact that, you know, the board, others could petition the board and force them to require immediate compliance with water quality standards with the provision written as it currently stands. So what we have done is actually proposed a rewriting of the water quality standard requirement to where it you divide it up between surface water limitations and groundwater limitations, recognizing that there's a difference between the two, and that basically, and the except as authorized by the time schedule provisions, we're going to show you a little bit later on, but we are proposing that the order specifically include time schedules that will allow 8 years for surface water and 15 years for tile drains and groundwater with respect to meeting water quality standards to give us that time to develop and implement management practices. So there is not that fear on our part of potential immediate enforcement and requirements with respect to compliance. And so this does that. Also, because we have expressed our concerns with how the table 1A has been identified, Ms. Fisher just did, instead of referencing that table, we suggest that you reference just the applicable standards in the basin plan, which is, of course, where all of your applicable standards are. This would be the groundwater limitation that mirrors the surface water limitation. You will see, and the deletion of the paragraph 22, to me, frankly, I didn't see a lot of difference between paragraph 21 and 22. It appeared to me that paragraph 22 is duplicative. They both basically were requiring compliance with water quality standards or with the basin plan. So instead, we've, you know, limited reference to the basin plan. This is a small change just to recognize that for the types of discharges that are covered by the order, it had organic materials such as organic pesticides. It is my understanding from talking to a few folks in the industry that there are a few registered pesticides that are not considered to be organic. So this is a small change just to change it to recognize that it covers registered pesticides. Now we get into the stormwater runoff issue, which there was some considerable discussion with at the last hearing with respect to the controlling that 1/2 inch of storm and some concern from many that they're not sure how they would accomplish that. So in order to address that concern and issue, we would recommend that we first of all strike the word treatment, because treatment signifies more of a point source type operation that you're actually going to have some type of facility that treats something, and instead replace it with water quality protective management practices, which I think is what we all are hoping for, and that we just remove the reference with respect to the controlling of the half-inch storm.
I just want to interrupt for a second. I think some of the things you're proposing are reasonable alternatives, but when I look ahead at your presentation, it seems like a lot of very significant changes, and not having had the opportunity for other parties or the board to even look at this in advance, I think will create an issue. And, you know, I think you need to explain why you think that's allowed.
Okay, do you want me to wait till I get to those, or do you want me to do that now?
Let me just look for 1 second where I think it comes up.
Okay. I think I'm okay for the next couple, so shall I go ahead?
Let's let her identify what page.
I think the new subpart E is
okay. When we get to new part E.
I think this part is addressing some of the issues that have been in dispute, but having a whole new subpart E, I think, is, and it looks like it's quite new and is of concern.
Well, we would disagree with that, and actually a lot of the changes we've made to the part E were to address some of the concerns as expressed by staff in the staff report.
Okay, why don't you give more about that when you get to there.
Okay. So this change to paragraph 38 is talking about the riparian corridor issue, and we are looking for a clarification that basically says that we should be maintaining to the extent feasible. You know, to have a requirement that seems to be an absolute as a must without some recognition that there has to be some feasibility associated with it. So we recommend that we include to the extent feasible. The next one on paragraph 39, again, is dealing with some of the riparian corridor issues. And we it currently says that, you know, where disturbance of aquatic habitat is necessary, but it limits it only for the purposes of water quality improvement or restoration activities. And we would contend that Well, you may need to disturb your aquatic habitat for other purposes as well. And in fact, there are many other regulatory programs that are there to protect aquatic habitat, such as the 404 permitting process, the stream bed alteration process. Some counties have ordinances, so there would still be significant protection for aquatic habitat for any type of disturbance that may need to occur. Paragraph 43, page 20. This is a change to the farm plan, and this is I would classify as a minor clarification, but a key clarification. Currently, you know, it has always been our expectation that the farm plans are remained on site and that they would be presented to regional board staff upon request at the farm or at site, and that they would not be submitted to the regional board because at that point they would become a public document. As currently worded, the draft order just says they have to be presented upon request, which to me could indicate the request could be sent into the regional board, automatically making it public. Our clarification is to ensure that what we all know and understand, that the intent is that they remained on farm and that they are given at the time that the inspection occurs at the farm. Paragraph 46.21, I actually recommend that we delete this whole paragraph, primarily because it is a recitation of existing law. It is not a condition of a waiver of the order. It basically is summarizing what the executive officer's authority might be under 13.267 and what could happen under 13.304, which is a cleanup and abatement order process, which is a whole other different process. So it seemed inappropriate to include it as a condition of the waiver. So we recommend that it be deleted because it serves no purpose with respect to the condition of the waiver. Paragraph 50, page 22. Originally, we had suggested that there be a completely different groundwater monitoring and a different monitoring MRP for those that select the ag alternative. We have rethought that, and we think that is not necessary, and instead we would maintain the MRP as it currently exists for all three tiers with some adjustments for those that would select the ag alternative. The adjustments being that some of the reporting requirements for Tier 3, which is one of our fundamental objectives with the ag alternative, would no longer apply. So we've specified which parts of the Tier 2 MRP and which parts of the Tier 3 MRP would apply to those who elect Part E and those who do not. And I would also say as we get there, you're going to see that we have withdrawn or we are suggesting instead of the original groundwater monitoring alternative, we have taken staff's current language as proposed in the September 2011, and we are suggesting some modifications instead of something completely new. Page 52 is just to recognize that the MRPs do have a cooperative groundwater monitoring program or alternative for groundwater, and so this is a change to reflect that. Page 56, paragraph 24. I know this is difficult to read on the slide. I apologize to those of you in the audience in particular. If the board were to adopt the ag alternative in the Part E, then there would need to be a need for people to select that option within their notice of intent process. And there also, if there is a potential for a cooperative groundwater monitoring program like there is for surface water, then people would need to be able to select that option. So the first two changes are in order to indicate those options. And so people would have to let the board know which options they are selecting. The deletion of the last one is being suggested that to be deleted for a couple of reasons. One, you're already requiring a farm and ranch map. So I would assume that as part of the map, any type of streams would be already identified with on the map, so there's no need to have a standalone requirement with respect to requiring an indication of the presence of streams within the property. I also suggest deleting this last one here because it also talks about, identification of any wetlands area. Well, as many of us know, sometimes it takes a biologist and a complete wetlands delineation process in order to determine what is an actual wetland. And I don't think that's something we want to require growers is to go out and hire a biologist to conduct a wetlands delineation on their property. Part E. All right. So with respect to Part E, why we don't believe it makes any substantive changes. Okay. First of all, it is absolutely fundamentally still a third-party program that people elect and have the option to join. We have been asked whether there are criteria for the third party. We have now developed some criteria for the third party in order for the executive officer to make this determination whether he thinks he or she thinks that the third party is actually able to conduct the work that we need to be conducted. So that continues to exist. There is still the requirement that all farms be audited or within the term of the order, that at least 20% would have to be done. We have included some new reporting requirements because the board has indicated that they wanted some additional reporting requirements, some explanation with respect to reporting requirements. We have incorporated some of the reporting elements as testified to by Mark Los Heritos at the hearing orally. So that is why we don't believe what we are doing is anything beyond what has already been discussed within the confines of the record. We have also made changes to address one of the fundamental concerns that the board staff has had with respect to requirements with water quality standards. We have removed language talking about working towards improving water quality standards and has a provision specific to dealing with and implementing management practices for water quality standards. So those would be the reasons why we don't believe that our Part E as proposed here is fundamentally different from what was in the original Part B. The process is changed slightly, again, to reflect some of the concerns with respect to timing. But again, it's still an audit program with reporting summarized and, you know, accountability to the board. So with that, do you want me to go ahead and go through the text? Am I allowed?
Well, without having been able to go through it, it's hard to say if what you've just stated is accurate. But generally, the rule is if there's new written evidence, it's.
I don't believe this is evidence. This is suggested language changes to incorporate our proposal, as we've discussed previously, in a slightly different format and with some new provisions that address staff concerns as expressed in the staff report.
Well, I think it's up to the chair if you
it's fine with
it.
It's fine with me.
Okay.
Yeah. I'd rather her go ahead and discuss what's in here. There's a lot of material, and staff is going to have to respond to it.
And what I would suggest is if there's any other party who wants to have a little bit more time to also respond, that would make sense.
Yeah, I don't see it as evidence per se.
It's
a proposal on language changes.
Right, but the question is, does it prejudice any party to the proceeding? And without having it ahead of time, how can you know? But I think it's okay to go ahead, but just provide additional time for staff and other parties to provide.
Well, if anyone feels that they're prejudiced by it, they can let us know if they need additional time. We'll deal with that request at that moment. So go ahead.
All right, here we go. Okay, so how this would work,
sure.
I'm trying to put it.
Excuse me, Ms. Dunham. Yes, Mr. Johnston.
My only question is, if we're going to allow staff and other stakeholders to respond to this, I know there's a limited number of copies, but I'm just wondering if there are, and I see staff is working off copies of it, I'm wondering if there are any other stakeholders that need copies of this to follow along on so that they can intelligently respond to it, because it's sure easier for me to follow this on the piece of paper than to track it on the screen there.
And I have a few more that I'm more than willing
okay,
for people
Mr.
to.
Okay, Mr. Nathan Alley, right? In the back. Mr. Shemek.
Box off, right?
Yeah.
Well, just if we need them.
I can auction it off. Maybe we can make some money to pay for the program. And I'm going to apologize in advance that I have broke absolutely every rule that exists with PowerPoint protocol with respect to how much verbiage is on these slides. It was the only way I could do it. Shall I?
I'm sorry to interrupt again. I have a question, Mr. Chairman. If as we go through this, if we staff believe that this is new information, what are our options? We can't undo it. We can't put the toothpaste back in the tube here.
You can let me know if you think that that's happening. I mean, I perused through this very quickly. This is language, proposed language changes. So, I mean, at first blush, that's the way I am receiving this. If there's new information, you can interrupt the speaker. Let me know. We'll stop the clock, and I'll hear you out.
Can I ask something?
I have a question. I have a question, too.
Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. Can you characterize for us what you're presenting? You say you've renamed Attachment B.
Yes.
So can you characterize for us how much of Attachment B survived this transition to the new Part E? Are we looking at, have you dropped half of what you proposed before, and are you inserting additional language that we really haven't read before? Because I don't have any way of understanding how much of a shift this is going to make at this point in time.
I have to say, I actually don't think it fundamentally makes a huge shift. Okay.
But what is that? What do you mean by fundamentally?
Okay. So is it still an audit program? Absolutely. Is it still an alternative to the Tier 2 and the Tier 3 reporting requirements? Absolutely. Is there still a requirement that all forms have to be audited within the term of the order? Yes. Is there a third party that conducts that? Yes. Does it better clarify that the audits are independent than what the Attachment B did? Is one of our intents to ensure that it's independent. Attachment B included requirements for a technical advisory committee as well as a public advisory committee. Mm-hmm. That's in here as well. It does, I think it probably puts a little bit more discretion to the executive officer to approving a third party as well as approving the work plan and the process for the third party to the executive officer of the regional board. It does, you know, within the original Attachment B, there's this whole appeals process for members of the group. That is not specified here because it seems that's more of an internal issue for any third party, and it's not necessarily a board issue. Have we clarified what the third party's reporting requirements are to the board? That you get a list of those in good standing, you get a list of those that are not in good standing. Mm-hmm. We've included some new reporting requirements because it appeared that there was an interest in that. We've included some new requirements specific to nutrient management because of such the concerns associated with nutrient management. So they're clear that nutrient management is a key provision versus just a part of the farm plan that was originally there. So we've tried to make some clarifications to make it a little clearer as to what this process would entail.
Okay. Thank you. That helps me.
Well, let me ask this. Is there any feeling by the rest of the board that we should not entertain a presentation of this Part E? Is it okay?
Just in the sense of fairness, I'm wondering if everyone knew this was allowable, might other parties have brought forth new language, number one? And number two, if we, the board or the staff, had come up yesterday with a new copy of the draft ag order that had new changes that no one had seen, what would we have heard today? Would we have heard that it's unfair because they didn't have chance to consider those changes in advance? And my last question is, could we have gotten this a week ago or 3 days ago?
Well, I doubt that you could have gotten it 3 days ago because there wasn't any allowance for additional written communication. So I only have the opportunity to present it to you today. And I believe there may be others that might have alternative language that they present today. I know that there are some folks in the environmental community who have been, for a better term, shopping around some alternative language that they shared with folks. So that may be presented today as well. So there may be others that have language. I don't want to speak for them. And they would have the same opportunity to present that language today as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnston and then Mr. Jeffries.
I would point out that at our last workshop in Salinas, I forget if it was Mr. Alley or Mr. Schimmick, proposed some changes that they thought would be appropriate to the order when talking about their conditional support of it. I would also say that, frankly, I have some revisions in my back pocket, too, that I haven't shared with other board members. It wouldn't have not have been appropriate. So, I don't have an issue with seeing what people think. I think the whole point of this discussion here today, of us listening to you folks, is to hear from stakeholders in general, not just yay or nay, but if there are changes that you believe should be made.
Okay, Mr. Jeffries.
I'm going to yield to Mr. Schimmick first, then I'll speak after he.
Well, you're going to come to the podium and identify yourself.
Steve Schimmick with Monterey Coastkeeper and the Otter Project.
Speak up.
Okay, thank you. The changes that we brought last time had been shown before, so there's nothing new there.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Just in response to a comment from Board Member Delgado, it is, and it's pretty much what Board Member Johnson said, is that it is appropriate for board members in deliberation to talk about changes to the order.
Absolutely.
To be responsive to comments, and it's part of the deliberative process. So that's what's expected. It isn't a question of up or down on one alternative or the other.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Jeffries.
This is a public hearing, and I encourage the board to listen to the rest of this because I think it's important in the changes. I don't see, and I haven't looked at all of it in detail, but it looks like there's some changes that may be considered, but I would like to hear them all in detail.
Okay.
And I encourage the board to accept these and let her present the rest of it.
Okay. I just want to make sure staff has an adequate amount of time to digest what's being proposed so we can have a educated discussion about, you know, what everything means.
Well, I'm sure by the end of the day, Mr. Chair, there'll be a lot of things to consider other than this.
Yeah.
And for the staff to digest and give us their response.
Okay. All right. Mr. Thomas.
I've just a request. Of Ms. Dunham, do you have a red line strikeout of your former attachment B that would help us see what the changes are?
I do not. I'm sorry, I didn't do it that way.
Okay. Shall we proceed?
Okay.
Okay. You, and just so you know, there's 21 and a half minutes left.
I will try. Okay. So on this part E, first, you know, we recognize that people have to have time in order to indicate to the board that they would select this option. So we've identified that they would basically have 60 days, which I think is matches basically the notice of intent time frames. If it doesn't match it exactly, then we can change that, but that was the intent. The second part is that in order to continue to fall and remain under the third-party program, all of the conditions in the subpart B must be met, and those are conditions and requirements upon third party as well as the discharger, and ultimately the discharger is the one responsible, which is one of the main concerns that the staff report often had was, well, who's responsible, the discharger or the third party? If a third party doesn't do what it's supposed to do, then the problem comes to the discharger, and therefore they are responsible. And I will just add that is the process of how it works in Region 5. I think it's important for this board to understand that coalition and third party approaches have been going on in Region 5 since 2003. Those approaches have been upheld by the State Water Board in a precedential order, and they do not require individual reporting. So just keep that in mind as we go through this. So first, within the first 6 months, a third party that was going to administer this program would basically need to provide an application to the executive officer for approval. And there are some criteria here in order for the third party as to what they would need to be meet. First, they have to clearly show to the executive officer, and this is subdivision B1, Romanet 1, that the ability of that they have the third party to carry out these responsibilities. So it's not any fly-by-night group. It's not just, you know, it's got to be a credible group and organization that's going to be able to take on the responsibilities. We believe that that is important. That, two, that this new third party is some type of either a legally defined entity or working towards a legally defined entity, so there's some, you know, obligations and professional obligations to assure accountability, or that there's some type of memorandum of agreement between organizations. Three, if there's any subsidiary group that's a part of this, then they need to comply with all the same provisions as well. Next, the third party has to show what their governance structure is. And I will note these requirements, I didn't make them up. These come from the long-term irrigated lands program proposal for the Central Valley region. So these are basically reflecting what the Central Valley is looking at doing of requiring of their third parties. The next requirement after the governance structure is that you have to show that you've developed a technical advisory committee and that that technical advisory committee is capable of helping the third party to develop the content of the audible program and for a whole complete independent audit process. The third party also has to develop a public advisory committee. It's something we have talked about previously in order to provide input and feedback to the third party. We think that's a key provision, and that public advisory is ag, it's, you know, regulators, it's Monterey County Water Resources Agency, it's public health, it's whoever may be appropriate as another stakeholder to ensure a transparency and accountability within the process. Two, then in subdivision two, we basically have given the executive officer 30 days to approve the application for the third party. If the executive officer, if the staff thinks that 30 days is too short, we have no problems extending it, but we know we're on a vigorous time frame, and we wanted to keep timing aggressive in order to the third party can get formed and the program could be developed in as quickly a time frame as possible. Then 6 months later, that third party that's been approved by the EO has to basically submit their work plan, which was a part of the attachment B, but we've had some more specification as to what has to be in that work plan. They have to have developed an auditable farm plan template. So they're going to create an electronic template for growers to fill out that then can be audited for the independent audit program with all the appropriate information. They have to absolutely explain what that independent audit program structure is and how it would work. All this goes to the executive officer for approval. They need to propose, and here's a new addition for those of you wanting to know where the new additions are, that there is a specific template for nutrient management. We understand the board's concerns with respect to nutrients and nitrates, and we think it's important that we have our growers focus specifically on nutrient management. So we have included the fact that they need to develop a template for nutrient management that is then reported to the third party. That there is this process for prioritizing the farms for practice effectiveness evaluation. That means taking the highest risk farms as determined from the templates and the nutrient management plans and determining which ones are at the highest risk so we can go forward and actually evaluate their practices on their farm in order to determine if they're effective. And with that, we are also in a new addition is that with that, every farm would have to have one representative soil sample in order to indicate with respect to, you know, residual nutrient levels within the soil in order to help us to determine risk. Then there is, of course, the practice effectiveness evaluation program. We think this is absolutely key. Am I on the right slide? Yeah. No, sorry about that. That we think this is a key provision because it's where we actually start evaluating the program. The third party evaluates the effectiveness and management practices in order to determine which ones are working and which ones aren't, so we can better help growers, whether it's big growers or little growers, make changes to their operations in order so they can be more effective. And we will all learn from that. And with that report, you also need to identify who are the enrolled growers so we can make sure that your list at the water board and our list matches so people aren't lost in the shuffle somewhere saying that they notified you 60 days later, but they never enrolled with the third party, so it's important that we make sure that we keep everybody honest. We then have the annual reporting requirements. which we had talked about previously with some new additions in order to make it more robust. We, of course, have that you have to continue to audit at least 20%, and I want to say farms, right? There was some discussion as far as auditing growers. Ours is farms. One grower may have three farms. We're not saying that only the grower, maybe one farm out of three gets audited. All three farms have to be audited. So it's important distinction that in order to know, and that's 20% of the farms at a minimum, likely the program's going to have to be doing 25% per year in order to make sure they get to every farm within the term of the order. Also with the annual report would be a summary of independent auditor reports, and that's the summary report of the number of growers and farms participating, the number of growers and farms that failed the audit, and a summary of corrective actions taken by growers. There would also be a risk self-assessment summary that takes the data from the farms and tries to capture the types of risks that we're finding within the farms. So the regional board has more information, and we all have more information. There are farm water quality plan summaries. This would be taking that farm water quality plan template and providing some summaries to the regional board with respect to what actual practices are being implemented on the farm and which ones aren't. Most importantly, at each annual report, the regional board would receive a list of those participants who are in good standing and those that are not. And I have to be honest, this is something that the Central Valley Board and their third-party program really wishes they did have. They don't even have this much of an individual reporting requirement. We do believe that it's important that we provide this so the regional board knows who in the third party continues to be working in good faith moving forward. All of this would be spelled out in a work plan to the executive officer, and the executive officer would make the determination. And I would imagine there would be some collaboration back and forth as to the robustness of the program being proposed in order to approve this program as the approvable third-party program. There is then a subsequent report within 3 years with respect to the practice evaluations. Because we need more than 1 year to really to determine if practices are effective, that after 3 years of doing it, there would be a practice evaluation. So now, then there is also, here are some new things as well. Or actually, I don't think this is new. But anyway, the discharger has to also continue to comply with the monitoring requirements, which are still within the order, the surface water as well as groundwater. Obviously not the individual surface water monitoring requirements, but the cooperative surface water receiving water monitoring and the groundwater. That is a condition of maintaining eligibility for the program. The discharger obviously has to make sure that any information requested by the third party, they have to provide. If they're not going to cooperate for the third party, then it doesn't do us any good, and they would no longer be eligible for the third party. They would be told, their name would be, or letter would be sent to the regional board saying grower X, Y, and Z is no longer a participant in the third party or is not providing appropriate information. They would become back subject to the draft order as proposed. And here, number 8, I think, is probably one of the key provisions and changes with respect to trying to acknowledge or at least respond to some concerns expressed by staff, and that's with respect to the compliance of water quality standards. So we have drastically changed the language here, and it basically now would require dischargers to implement water quality management practices as identified through the audit process or just even as necessary in order to improve and protect water quality and to achieve compliance with applicable water quality standards, recognizing the time schedules, which I'm going to talk about here just shortly. The next thing would be if in the development of the third party, the executive officer denies a third party, we have built in a provision that would allow the third party to go to the board at the next reasonably available meeting to see if the board agrees with the executive officer's determination or not. And finally, D, failure by anybody, whether it's the third party or the discharger, will cause those dischargers in that third party to no longer be eligible. So that's the catch-all provision to make sure that everybody does what they're supposed to be doing. That's it. That's part E. Tried to simplify it, make it easier to understand. Going forward, so on paragraph 61, page 25, the changes here are, again, to recognize that if there is the part E If the board chooses to go that way, then we need a determination provision in order to allow folks, if they want to terminate or if they decide they no longer want to participate in the third party, what they need to do. So this is to recognize that. Says they have to notice the regional board, and then they become subject to Part F and G. Unless they're no longer a Tier 2 or Tier 3, then they would be subject to the Tier 1 provisions of the order. New paragraph 82. This would be new language that basically provides for time schedules for meeting water quality standards. Instead of the absolute language that currently exists, we would recommend that there be included time schedules that may be extended, but at the first outset, it would require that discharges from agriculture, and we've broken it up into three categories. There's discharges to surface water, excepting those from tile drains, discharges from tile drains, and then discharges to groundwater. And basically, we are proposing that ag will try to meet water quality, make sure that their discharges do not cause water quality standards to be exceeded within 8 years for surface water, 15 years for tile drains, and 15 years for groundwater. Now, of course, as we all develop more information, we may be able to better define what the appropriate timelines are. You know, we're all just kind of trying to go based upon what we know at this point in time, but there's a lot more to learn. But that is what we currently propose with respect to timeframes for compliance with water quality schedules. And paragraph 82 and paragraph is again a continuation of those. I'm starting to run out of time here, so I'm going to try to buzz right along without hoping not to lose the court reporter. Paragraph 82 is your existing time schedule language, and basically it just clarifies the application of the time schedules that we propose. The last couple of changes, I do propose deleting paragraphs 84, 85, and 86, and paragraph 87, primarily because I don't know that effectively control is a legal standard. Having a requirement that says that a discharger must effectively control individual waste discharges, to me, is not a legal standard. It's not tied to water quality standards. It's not tied to management practices. It's a statement that I'm not even sure how one would continue or determine compliance with. So I suggest deleting those. Table 4. As we talked earlier, Table 4 really isn't a time schedule, and I believe in the staff report it often says that Table 4 is not enforceable. It would be used by staff to determine discretion in enforcement. However, even with that, we think it's important to make conforming changes in order to recognize the election opportunity with Part E should the board decide to adopt it. And lastly, this big, really long, long slide, and again, my apologies. This is the groundwater cooperative paragraph that appears in all three MRPs. And this language basically is staff's language. We've added some changes in order to allow it to be a practical alternative. One, we have identified that there may be other types of qualifying cooperative programs that might want to try to see if it fits into the regional board's program. All would still have to meet the objectives, all still subject to the executive officer's approval. The last parts in red basically put forward a process in order to allow it to happen. It allows folks to elect this as an option and gives a year in order for this option to come forward and developed and approved by the executive officer. Without these changes, we are concerned that the staff alternative is an option with no implementation or with no availability. So we are hoping that these changes would make it a viable option for folks if they want to try to put together a cooperative groundwater monitoring program in lieu of the individual groundwater monitoring requirements that currently exist. But they would have the option. We haven't made any other changes to the groundwater monitoring requirements. Those are the end of my suggested changes. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip over. I have some slides that have some comparisons that if there are questions we can go into. But I'm going to go, one is a timeline of comparison. There's been some concerns that the ag alternative is going to take too long. And I believe there was some question and answer with respect that went out yesterday talking about time frames. So we wanted to provide just a side-by-side comparison of the time frames within the draft order as compared to the time frames if the board was to adopt the ag alternative. So, you know, it, obviously the requirements are different, but the time frames show that we are trying to put forward an angle alternative that has a very aggressive timeline, and that the first, you know, you were 60 days, you're making the election. 6 months, you have the EO hopefully looking at an application. You have then the EO approving it by October of 2012. It's not very far from now. So we're not talking a long time here of trying to get this up and running. Next, you have, yes, you have 6 months after the notice of applicability is issued, assuming that the EO took 30 days, you're talking by May of next year, you'd have the third party up and going and the audits beginning. You then would have your first set of audits by May 14th of 2014, which is before you'd start getting reports as far as nutrient balance ratios under the draft order. You would also have your first practice effectiveness evaluation summary by May of 2016, which is before you start getting water quality buffer plans. So we do think that this is aggressive, and we do think that things are going to happen on a very quick time frame. Want to go quickly into the legality of the ag alternative. So, you know, there's been a lot of discussion, and I do want to say that, and especially with respect to individual reporting, there is nothing in the Water Code that requires individual reporting. Water Code Section 13269 clearly discusses the fact that waivers can be for a type of discharge, and the monitoring provisions of 13269 specifically say that monitoring can be done individually or cooperatively. The Central Valley Board program, what's been going on since 2003, and as it's being proposed to be changed here within the next year, would not require individual reporting at the type that is discussed in this draft order. It may be that the staff here decides they find it the most effective way for them, but that is a completely different question as compared to whether it is legal. Summary reports are often done within this type of a program. And again, the State Water Board has approved a coalition approach. The non-point source policy encourages a coalition approach. And therefore, there's no legal impediment to adopting this our alternative today that would include summary reporting and not individual reporting. I also want to remind you that I think earlier there was a slide with respect to the legislative intent of Porter Cologne. Well, there's another provision in that same legislative intent that also clearly says that it's the regional board's obligation to regulate to attain the highest water quality, which is reasonable considering all the demands. I think the drafters of Porter Cologne, frankly, were brilliant. When you look at the policy and the statute as a whole, it talks about balancing and reasonableness. And when you look back at all the legislative history that goes along with it, and I've read it all, everything was about balancing all of the different needs to be placed upon the water. Not one goes over the other. It's balancing all of them. And everything that we do and you do as the regional board, you need to make a balancing determination with respect to all the different needs. So I would also say to you that, you know, it is your job to determine the validity of the third party. And it's not determining whether, yes, our proposal is different than the draft order. Yes, it does remove some of the individual requirements, which is why we're proposing it. There, I think, been some unfair comparisons that say, well, but it has a different standard for those under the third party versus those that aren't under the third party. That's the idea. That's the purpose of it, is to create a different standard that, frankly, we think provides and gets to better water quality sooner than the program as proposed within the draft order. And you have to ask, do you think it's consistent with the Water Code, the Basin Plan, the non-point source policy, and state board orders? I would absolutely contend that it does and that it is consistent, as I've noted some of the state board presidential orders and other programs that are very similar to what we've talked about. And again, it is a different standard. It is not a less stringent standard. And again, one of the other criticisms we've talked about, does it require compliance with water quality standards? Yes, it does. We've actually made some significant changes in trying to address that concern with staff. And, of course, we are suggesting some time schedules that don't currently exist. Does it protect sources of drinking water? Yes, we believe it does, or starts working in that area by calling out the need for nutrient management. working with the growers and the technical advisory committee to make sure that that occurs. And I will wrap up. I'm on the last couple of slides. We've talked about all the reporting elements and the time frames and the conclusions.
Okay. Time is up. There's no 5 minutes left, was it? Or did you?
I started at 55.
You did at 55. Okay. Question I have for you, Ms. Dunham. Does the current Region 5 order allow for reporting to a coalition and not directly to the Water Board? You said something is being proposed,
well,
and I'd like you to clarify that.
Sure.
Who is proposing what, and what currently exists?
What currently exists in Region 5 actually is even less than what your 2004 order does. Under the Region 5 orders, people don't even file a notice of intent with the regional board. They sign up with the coalition, and the coalition then lets the regional board what parcels are covered within their program. There is no direct reporting currently between individuals and the Central Valley Regional Board. And I will say that this has not hampered Region 5's ability to bring enforcement actions. They have brought several enforcement actions against individual growers who have had excessive sediment leaving their property. And in large part, it's coalitions that basically have had concerns with growers within their coalition who have suggested the regional board do something with respect to enforcement.
Can I just add to that, that the Region 5 order does...
And speak up, please.
The Region 5 order authorizes the executive officer and the board to request farm plans that are then turned into the regional board. So that is a difference that with the proposal that Ms. Dunham proposes, that plans are actually submitted to the regional board upon request.
There is no generic requirement that that be done. That is maybe a discretionary element.
Yeah,
but
I agree with you.
Specific requirement that each grower prepare a farm plan
just
that is submitted to the regional board.
One at a time.
Yeah, sorry. I just want to make sure that the board knows that, that there's more than just what you said, because there is a you proposed to delete the requirement that farm plans be submitted to the regional board. Region 5's order provides that farm plans be submitted.
Hold up.
Sorry.
Hold up, Francis.
Okay. Okay, I just wanted to make sure that it's clarified that Ms. Dunham proposes to delete a requirement that people turn in their farm plans to the regional board, but the Region 5 order allows the regional board to request farm plans to be turned into them.
But right
That's
now,
all.
The Region 5 doesn't even require the development of farm plans.
And is this Region 5's first ag order?
It's a convoluted process, but they started in 2003. It's been amended a few times, and they are now in the process of going from their base program that's been in place since 2003 with some tweaks along the way to what we're calling what they call the long-term irrigated lands program, and they're in the process of developing WDRs for different coalitions at this moment in time. They did a very long facilitated stakeholder process with a professional hired facilitator and have came out with a long-term irrigated lands program. They did a environmental impact report, and they're now just starting to put forward those changes. And there is no farm plan specific requirement in Region 5. Whether, you know, the board may request one of some individuals, which this board, anybody could do, any board could do under 13267 authority. There's no specific requirement that says every grower in Region 5 must prepare a farm plan and submit it to the coalition or even the regional board.
Okay. All right. Mr. Johnston?
Yeah, on the subject of Region 5, I don't have internet. I just tried to pull it up. As I recall, it does require the coalition to report to the board the management practices that are being performed and the specific areas where they're being performed, the specific geographic areas. And then if the board thinks has questions about the adequacy, they can request a management plan from the individual dischargers.
Well,
so it seems like there's a higher level of reporting, and it seems like what's being proposed here is summary reporting further down the road, late in the process. I think that's a little difference between, as long as we're citing Region 5,
yeah,
I think
well
that's a bit of a difference.
I would disagree with that characterization, I'm sure, and Mr. Thomas, who represents one of the specific coalitions, could probably help expound upon that as well. But
good.
How the Region 5 order works is, first, if there's a trigger, and right now the Region 5 program is surface water only, and it's and specific to surface water only, the coalitions conduct surface water monitoring. If there is an exceedance of a water quality standard, then the coalition basically might be triggered, if the EO says, oh yeah, I think this is significant enough, may be required to prepare a management plan. And part of that management plan requires the coalition to go out and discuss and survey management practices within that watershed or that sub-watershed area. And then the coalition has to develop and report back with respect to those management practices in a summary fashion. I don't believe they are parcel to parcel specific. No farm plans, not parcel specific. The coalition does all of that. And in fact, individuals in the coalition that I work with will go in and greet and meet with every grower, but again, that's part of their management plan that is done within the development of the management plan. So, and all that reporting, again, is summary if the management plan has been triggered.
Go ahead.
So if there's an exceedance, but the data then, or the actions that are taken at watershed or sub-watershed level, how do you connect the source and the hotspot with this broad approach?
The coalition actually, and in my the coalitions that I work with, will actually, especially if it's a pesticide exceedance, they'll go to the county ag commissioner. They will find out who filed pesticide use reports for that specific pesticide and applied it at that time period, and they'll go focus and talk to that individual and say, hey, what are you doing? Did you do it right? Did you do this? Did you control this to make sure that next time, you know, to see if they might be the person or to make sure they're implementing appropriate management practices. So they're kind of specific with respect to using pesticide use reports in order to get at that, to go up the water stream, the watershed, in order to key point in on the individuals that it might be.
So in the context of looking at a sub-watershed area, and say you have four growers, would all four growers be approached and asked to do the same process of?
Yes. If all four growers had applied the pesticide of concern at that point in time, yes, all four growers would receive a visit and would be talked to about with respect to management practices.
And what if all four growers said, gee, I don't think I'm doing anything that's contributing to that. Is that the end of it, or what
now,
happens
well,
at that point?
Well, once a management plan is developed, there's continued follow-up monitoring and more specific monitoring for that management plan so you can see whether people are actually doing what they're supposed to be doing or not.
Okay.
And eventually, there would be, if you think someone's completely in violation, the coalition would probably say something to the regional board that, hey, you know, we've got some folks here that aren't necessarily implementing appropriate management practices.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, Mr. Johnston, were you done with your questions, just to be complete?
For the moment.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Jordan.
Stenham, I'm just curious. I don't know anything about Region 5 either. So if we had one of those nice color-coded maps for you to put up there, would it be apples to apples in comparison to the nitrate issues here and the toxicity issues?
You know, I'm sure that there might be some apples to apples in different hotspots, right? You know, I think that you got to look at everything on a constituent-by-constituent basis, and there are definitely some areas of Region 5 that have higher issues with respect to toxicity and some that have, issues with respect to nitrates. But I don't know. I can't answer that directly, but there are areas in the valley that have serious concerns for both those.
While you're citing that as a credible alternative, then that might be a reference point to provide in the future, just because you may say you want to look at it site by site, but the visual picture of all the impaired sites up on a PowerPoint presentation is a pretty chilling fact for this region.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right.
I believe, and we do have some extra copies, thanks to my colleagues. So
wonderful.
We have some more for
Is there anybody in the audience that wishes a copy of Ms. Dunham's presentation?